Hello, everybody. As a public service reminder, I would just like to remind everyone for the duration of the podcast, please stay on the bike. That's right. You are listening to Sparkwood and 21, the No Ship Network podcast on the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, head on over to noship.net where you can find all of the other podcasts we do. If you like horror, we have Penny Dreadful and Ash vs. Evil Dead. If you like historical, we have Vikings and Spartacus. And if you're like us, we also have The Handmaid's Tale and American Gods. Contact us through Gmail and leave us a review on iTunes. Also, check out the TV Time app. It lets you keep track of all your favorite TV shows as well as participate in a community of like-minded fans. Check it out. It's cool.
So as per usual, we will be following up this coverage with a feedback podcast. The difference is we're going to give you more time to write into us just in case some of you want to rewatch other episodes and comment on the series as a whole. It also gives us time to kind of think about it a little bit more and for us to respond to your emails more thoughtfully. So we will not record until next week. So the deadline will now be for feedback Sunday, September 10th at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. All right, before we get into recap, just want to remind everybody that we will be announcing the winner for the drawing at the end of this podcast, so stay tuned. We are discussing The Return, Part 18, What is Your Name? And we start out in the lodge. Mr. C burns in a chair. Mike applies electricity to the seed and Coop's hair, creating a brand new Dougie. He asks, "Where am I?" excitedly. And then we get to see Dougie go home. And this time he says home without actually repeating somebody else saying it first.
So we've got like a Dougie 3.0 here.
Yes.
So which is an upgrade off of the last Dougie, which was an improvement off of the last Dougie. So they're steadily getting, they're never going to get a Cooper, but they're steadily getting better Dougie Tulpas.
Exactly.
It's not a bad deal when you think about it.
I think it depends on who's creating them.
Yes, and what they used. Like, what did they use the last time they made Dougie?
Yeah,
and I think that's a good point, like how they're used, because that goes back to the conversation Hawk had with Sheriff Truman when they were going over the map. And, you know, electricity is applied to create this Dougie, so the intent behind it does affect the overall result.
That's a good point. That's a good point. So this, you can tell right off the bat that Mike made this one and imbued it with goodness and caring, you know, and he wants to be there. He's like home. He's happy.
Yes.
So did Mr. C make his own, or did he employ Mike to do it? Just wondering.
If Mr. C's the one that made it.
Well, technically, this is Cooper's hair, and Mike is making it. He's the one we always see saying electricity, and it's almost like he's there to generate that. Like, that's one of his primary functions.
Yeah.
Where Mr. C, who is the dark shadow of Cooper, just, I don't think he's really, I mean, he is powerful in the sense that he has strength, but, I mean, can he actually create something? Well, we've never seen him use electricity in that way.
No, that's a good point. That's a good
point. Just wondering.
No, absolutely.
He may have had to use Mike to do it. He probably had to twist his arm.
Oh.
I know Mike's allegiance has been questionable, especially in the original series.
Yeah.
But it seemed more clear as far as where he allied himself in this, in The Return. I don't know.
I mean, what if the evil version of the evolved arm did it? He would do something like that, wouldn't he?
Yeah, actually.
He would help him make it and make it kind of weird, twisted, like not exactly how Mr. C wants it either. That weird gambling, prostitute sleeping with version, you know?
Yeah, see, the arm has a doppelganger, but Mike doesn't. We've never seen Mike have a doppelganger, and he's also the only one who never had a host body that looked different than him. So he's something.
He's a singularity.
He's something, different. Yeah, but let's not. Yeah, I guess I'm sorry. I don't mean to.
This discussion for another day.
We've had this discussion. Why are we bringing it up again? Okay.
Now, we did miss a great opportunity when Coop is burning up. For Mike to have taken the ring and just thrown it right at his head and give him the Leland treatment. You stole the corn! You know, just slap him in the head with the ring and just get all animated and excited about it.
So we get another, he's either Cooper's doing it again, or it's just we're seeing the scene again from part 17 where Coop is trying to lead Laura out and he fails, where she again is whisked away after hearing some clicking noises, and she screams.
So there's nothing to back this up, but I feel like this was a repeat, like exactly, of the scene from the previous episode, just to let you know where we're at.
Exactly.
That no time has elapsed.
No.
This is just we're these two episodes are of a piece, but Showtime is making us put credits and an opening scene, you know, and a little plug for Ray Donovan in between them.
Yeah, right. So, just in case you've forgotten, this is what happened 10 minutes ago.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's a ton of people out there who are waiting till next week to watch this. Yeah.
So Cooper is now transported to the lodge, and Mike asks him, is it future or is it past? Mike vanishes for now, and Cooper peers intently at the empty chair, which is, this is Laura's chair. And I think this signifies to him that maybe he has some success with what he was attempting to do to pull Laura out.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I don't know that it's success in the sense that he was getting all of his goals achieved, but he kept her from dying.
Yeah, he changed something.
Right. He changed something. She got put into an alternate dimension or alternate reality, doesn't know who she is, living in Odessa, Texas, the whole nine yards, but she did not have to go through what Laura Palmer went through in the train car. That's kind of been expunged from history, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, Mike did just ask him, is it future or is it past? So it could be past as in before February 23rd, 1989, and Laura just hasn't arrived yet.
Oh. Huh. Yikes.
It's slippery in here.
Yeah, right?
It's what?
It's slippery in here.
Yeah, it's very slippery in here.
So Mike gestures for Coop to follow and is brought before the arm. The arm again says, I am the arm and I sound like this. And then the arm says, is it the story of the little girl who lived down the lane? Now, we've heard somebody mention something along these lines before, and that was Audrey Horne.
Mm. Well, this is a teaser because here we get mention of Audrey, who had no appearance in the previous part and has no appearance in this part. Which, all right, whatever. You know, I'm kind of okay with that. What's your take on it?
I just want to know, why is it linked? If she's not physically going to appear within this episode, but so why allude to her, or why was what she was saying alluding to this? Well, how is it connected? Why is it connected? That's what I can't figure out.
Well, is Laura the little girl who lived down the lane at this point?
That's what I would think.
The subject of it has changed. Or maybe it hasn't changed. Maybe Audrey was referencing that as well.
Mm-hmm. She's just trapped inside the lodge or somewhere in the evolved arm nose. So it's kind of like, or is in contact. I mean, it all depends on where she's at. And that's just to show that maybe she's trapped in the lodge or something akin to it.
Is the girl from 1956 the little girl that lived down the lane?
I don't know. It's a good idea, though. I mean, there's several girls that could fit the description. That's a good point, because I haven't even thought of her. Whoever she is, the bug eating.
Okay, so we'll just move on since we don't know how to explain that. We see Laura whisper to Cooper again, and she's then whisked away in the lodge space. Coop stands before Leland, and Leland says, "Find Laura." Coop hears a ringing tone, and he begins walking in that direction through the lodge space. And he enters a curtain and he exits out into Glastonbury Grove with the curtain still behind him. Mm. And there stands Diane before him. They approach each other. She asks, is it you? He says, yes, it's really me, Diane. And then he asks, is it really you? And she says, yes.
So this is, they're feeling each other out to make sure that he's not Mr. C and he needs to make sure she's not a tulpa.
Yeah.
I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. At any rate, this scene has a little bit of added weirdness to it because they seem to have had their reunion in the previous part when she, you know, when NATO kind of implodes or explodes or however you want to do it. And then you get the, as you called it, the Ronald McDonald version of Diane is right there. So then, but they're feeling each other out again. It's almost like they're meeting again for the first time.
Well, I'm meeting again or just making sure it's safe. I mean, I really think that it's kind of like just a check to make sure that someone else nefarious isn't putting them in place to attack each other, especially with him coming out of the lodge. Who knows? He could have split again and another doppelcoop could have come out.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way to look at it. They're feeling each other out to make sure it's the real McCoys.
Yeah. Now, could they have come up with a code that would have been better than, is that you? Or is that you? Sure, yeah. But hey, it works.
It is weird that she knew to wait for him there after, you know, when he walked through the door in the boiler room that he said, don't follow me.
Yeah.
You kind of got the feeling that there was a final.
Mm-hmm.
But unless they've had some sort of behind the scenes discussions where there was a plan to meet.
Yeah. Well, if you consider she was in the lodge for a certain amount of time, if that's where she was at, because it shows it in her head, maybe she's lived through this too and knows that she needs to be there on her own, right? You know, who knows what she knows being in there for as long as she was.
True. Yeah, she would know where the exit is.
Yeah.
And to be hopefully. Like, all right, I'm going to wait.
So the curtains vanish behind them, and then now Diane and Cooper driving through the desert. Power lines run parallel on their right. Diane asks, are you sure you want to do this? You don't know what it's going to be like once we... And he interrupts with, I know that. We're at that point now. I can feel it. Almost exactly 430 miles. Now they're parked. Diane says, just think about it, Cooper. Cooper gets out and walks up the shoulder a short distance, and you can hear crackling electricity. Now back in the car, he tells Diane, this is the place, and then asks her to kiss him. Once they cross, it could be all different. She says, let's go. He drives the car, and they are transported. It's almost like they're spit out in a way, like there's so much force behind them that mm-hmm. ejects them onto this night road.
Yeah, because they're driving pretty well. The film is sped up, but you get that impression that they're just driving real fast, and then time catches up with them,
yeah.
Or they catch up with time in its linear quality at that time.
And we have this long stretch of silent driving here between them, which parallels, you know, another scene later that we'll have with Carrie Page and Cooper. It just seems like there's just so much weighing on their minds, and this is some deadly serious thing, or what they're up to is deadly serious. So I think that's the reason why they're so quiet. And after this moment has passed, and at the end of the scene, it fades to black. We next see them pull into a one-story motel. Still not speaking, Coop gets up, goes in. Diane watches from the car, and she sees her double. She doesn't seem surprised. She doesn't respond emotionally in any way.
No, not at all. It's just like she's just watching somebody watch her who's actually her and has no response to that.
Right.
This is at the point where they leave Glastonbury Grove and they start driving, and they have this conversation that Emma's just described about apparently a barrier and Diane's reservations about crossing it. This is where everybody is lost. Nobody knows how to process this. There's just going to be some theories coming up online, and there's going to be some people who think they've got it figured out.
Yeah.
But nobody saw this coming. No, if you asked anybody during any of the previous parts, what do you think is going to happen in the finale? Oh, there's going to be this scene of quiet driving between Cooper and a red-haired Diane for minutes on it. Sorry, it just didn't happen. And so we're all on the same page now. And we don't know what that page is. We don't even know what the book is. We're just kind of like, did they cross? So they knew they were crossing into a different either time zone or dimension when they went through that barrier, because they knew that things were going to be different. They just didn't know how different. And so it's so different that Diane is okay seeing herself look at her. So there could be a number of Cooper and Diane's walking around in this plane of existence from that came to this dimension through different points in time.
Yeah.
So do you think it's maybe like this hotel is maybe like some sort of weird safe haven for, I don't know.
Safe haven or way station to go to different points, you know, just not as creepy as the other places that they've been to. You know, it's just a motel.
So it's like a gas station, but it's a motel instead.
So the motel transports you.
Yeah, well, whatever you do in the motel, you know, like maybe you smoke crack and you go to a bad place, or I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
sparkle. Get a hold of some good sparkle.
Sparkle, have some weird, awkward sex, send you to wherever they went.
So Coop has gotten them a room, and it's room number 7. They go inside. She at first turns on the light, which is really bright, and he asks her to turn it off and tells her to come over to him. And he says, Diane. They kiss and they begin to make love. And during this scene, the Platters are playing My Prayer, which is the song that played in part 8 that was coming over the radio when people were passing out. And the God of Light guy was there crushing the DJ's head and the frog bug end up crawling into that girl's mouth. And I had to really think about, why would you play this? Because it also reminded me of the Norma and Ed scene, because the song was coming in and out like the Otis Redding song did.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of like its opposite, where the Otis Redding was like, anytime it was playing, it was showing, yes, love is happening. Like, because it would stop like when it seemed like, oh, Ed and Norma weren't going to come together. And then once it was like, yes, they are, the Otis Redding song kicks right back on. I think the Platters comes in because Diane is struggling to unsee Mr. C because he raped her. So that's why she's trying to cover Cooper's face, because she cannot not see him anymore. And so I thought about it further, and I feel like I understand part eight a little bit more, at least in particular that scene in 1956 with the little girl. I think that the frog bug was there to kind of give us a visceral reaction to a violation, where you have this thing invade her body. So I think that's supposed to kind of be representative of a sort of trauma that can happen to someone, like rape, that will never ever leave you. And I think it's also part of another larger story, because before we see that scene with the little girl in 1956, we see 1945 in New Mexico, and we see an atom bomb, which is, I think, the original violation. So I think we might have looked at it wrong when we were thinking it opened up this rent and we had evil come in.
Yeah.
I think maybe the mother was probably always there, and she wasn't necessarily inherently evil. Like, she probably had both good and evil, but that particular introduction of the atom bomb amplified that, opened it up, and caused it to just be emptied out onto us. And it's had its reverberations throughout time. And it's expressed itself as cancer, as drug abuse, as sexual abuse, like as we've seen with Laura.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a really, really like cool way to look at that.
So the frog bug becomes a metaphor for rape, in a sense, or sexual violation. And so because I didn't catch it at first. M had to point it out, the Platters song playing at the same one and eight. I didn't make that connection. And so there you have it. When she's covering, because it did occur to me when she's covering Cooper's face, that she couldn't stop seeing Mr. C in her head, and she wasn't able to go through with the act and live in that moment, because she kept thinking about the violation from before. But I didn't think about it being on a metaphorical level like that.
And maybe on a mythological level. So if you think about like what's happened here, this violation to this entity, and maybe she became an extreme negative being because of this event in 1945. So if you think about like the goddess Demeter, whose daughter Persephone was taken from her down into Hades, and then she ate the pomegranates. And so those, she has to spend that amount of time every year down in Hades because the amount of pomegranates she ate. So that's the reason why we have winter, because Demeter grieves and she doesn't allow the earth to produce fruit and everything like that. So there's a cost to that sort of violation that the creator had. So I'm just looking at it like that. So I think there's more that's going to happen in here that will kind of support a little bit of that, but we'll get to that when we get there. So the scene also reminded me of Janie E and Dougie having sex, because we have the same exact view, the camera coming from behind, the same exact sexual position. Janie E and Diane are built in a similar fashion. Cooper wasn't that responsive. He was a little bit, but he wasn't as responsive as you would expect.
Yeah, he looked very dead fish-like. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. I mean, he almost facilitated looking like Mr. C the way he was just kind of staring at her. It's like, dude, come on, man. I'd cover your face up too. Quit staring at me all creepy.
The only indication you had that he was actually somewhat involved, you had a quick shot of him fondling her breast, and it was super quick.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Dougie at least looked like he was enjoying himself.
Oh, he was actually holding onto her waist, too. Mm. I should say that. So the it also reminds me of the scene from Mulholland Drive where Diane Selwyn is masturbating, and she's trying to see, I think she was trying to see, not Rita, what was Rita's name? fuck, Laura Elena's Herring's character's name. I remember Rita, but I don't remember her other name. But she's trying to see her face and she can't make it happen. So that kind of reminded me of this too. But so Cooper wakes the following morning. The room's bathed in sunlight. He calls for Diane and he finds a Dear Richard note. And in the note, Linda says, "I don't recognize you anymore." So here's another Richard and Linda, which is super confusing.
Right.
So is Cooper Richard now?
Sure.
These people are, they're going to, once they drove past that 430 mile barrier, they started to change and they're not going to stop changing.
Yeah.
I think they're just going to keep becoming, you'll stay a certain person for a certain amount of time. So they stayed as Cooper and Diane for that, however long it took them to get to the hotel.
Yeah.
Then they switched into Richard and Linda at some point, maybe overnight, I don't know. And then when they wake up, Cooper doesn't realize that who Linda is or who Richard is. He just remembers Rich. He says it out loud to kind of give us, the audience, an indication that he remembers the fireman saying Richard and Linda in the first part. But and as you can tell, as he leaves, I'm sure you're about to cover all this, so I'll leave it to you. But
so you do think he remembers that? Because he does say Richard and Linda, but he doesn't like detail what was said to him specifically.
No, but there wasn't a whole lot behind Richard and Linda when the fireman gave it to him, was there?
No,
so
he just said
it was kind of, it was just like a repeating it. And I think that's supposed to let us know that he remembers it, but he doesn't know what to do with it.
So when he leaves the motel, it is a two-story building when he exits. So it's no longer the one-story motel that they entered. Mm-hmm. The car park is now parked further away. It's a different car. There's palm trees out front. So I'm thinking this is California.
It's very windy out as well, and you
Santa
just
Santa Ana winds.
Yeah, the Santa Ana. It's a completely different landscape. I mean, you were like, this place felt like a hotel in the middle of the desert the night before, you know, and then now it's just in the crappy side of town somewhere on the suburbs of L.A. or I don't know, somewhere like that.
So now he's driving into Odessa, Texas. I was curious as to why Odessa. Odessa means, I looked up what Odessa could mean, and it's actually the feminine form of Odysseus. There's also a Greek definition, which means full of wrath. Also the town of Odessa, if you're looking at the Urban Dictionary, people who live there call it slow Odessa, because it's not a town that you can really thrive in. It's kind of not a lot to do, not a lot of upward mobility.
Every state has those towns.
Also, Odessa is another.
Odessa.
It's a town full of hoes, according to the Urban Dictionary.
Oh, my goodness.
So he stops at Judy's coffee shop. When he walks in, you can hear the clinking of the cutlery. I could almost smell that diner.
Right?
There's just something about the sound design that nailed it. As Cooper is seated, he asks the waitress if there is another waitress that works here. She says yes. It's her day off. Actually, it's her third day off. Cooper ends up having to defend this waitress against three rotten cowboys. One of them pulls a gun on him. Cooper disarms him. The second reaches for his gun, so Cooper shoots him in the foot. Cooper then tells the other to put his gun on the ground and sit down.
This guy tries to bluff him, too. He's all like, "I don't have a gun." He's like, "Put your gun on the ground." Like, are you an idiot? I mean, the answer is yes. But, I mean, like, you just saw what this guy did. Give it up. Live to fight another day. You know, do what he's, you know, because it's like, oh, that's my weapon. That's how I'm going to defend myself. You're just going to get shot.
Exactly.
By this guy.
So this is really the only action we got out of Cooper in these two parts, because Freddie fought Bob.
Yep. And what's your name? Shot him and put down Mr. C.
Uh-huh. Lucy.
Yeah.
Cooper tells the waitress to write the address of the other waitress on a piece of paper. He lifts the fry basket out of the fryer, which I was actually quite grateful for, because I was like, oh my God, they've been in there for too long. You can tell by the look of them.
Dark.
And it was like, just like, in my awareness the whole time. And because it seemed like you could hear him for a while before he even walked over there. And but he was lifting it up not to be helpful, but to actually place the guns that he absconded from the three men into the the oil. And he says to the cook behind the fryer, I don't know if the oil is hot enough to set off those bullets, so I'd move away.
That's what I was thinking when he first dropped them in. I'm like, man, that's kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm glad he said something like, hey, get back, because this might fuck these, you know, these bullets might go off.
They would definitely do that. I mean, I don't say definitely because I've never dropped a gun into a fryer. But I would say that there's a high probability that this would happen. I've been around a fryer where somebody's dropped a lighter into it. Mm-hmm. And this thing exploded over everybody. Everybody got a little bit burnt. It was bad.
Oh, yeah.
But
wasn't on purpose.
It was on purpose. It was done by accident. Somebody had it in there.
It wasn't me. That's not why I'm being defensive of the person.
It was a manager of mine at a fast food establishment when I was in high school. Anyway, he had it in his shirt pocket, and he was bending over, cleaning the fryer, and it fell into the amount of grease that was still left, and it exploded.
Man.
But I was a little disappointed in Cooper in this scene because I felt like when he lifted up the fry basket, number one, it's obvious where it goes. You just hook it right there. It's self-explanatory, and Coop's a sharp guy. And having spent my life in the food service industry, I would, you know, hope maybe, I know I've read My Life, My Tapes, and there's no talk of him being a service employee per se, but I would have thought that maybe he did a summer or two, you know, slinging some dishes, you know, doing some rudimentary fry work, but alas, it's not to be.
No. Mm-mm.
I'll get over it, though.
Well, I was more disappointed in the fact that he sounded like Mr. C in this scene.
Yeah, he was very abrupt.
Weird.
He's different. That's the whole point I was trying to get to. Like, you change once you go past that barrier. Like he said, everything can be different, and he is different. He's not like Mr. C necessarily. I think what happens is Mr. C was an extrapolation, like the complete, like, distilled negative side of him as a doppelganger. So this is just the part of him that's coming out, and this incarnation of Coop is able to bring that kind of nastiness to the surface when it suits his needs a lot quicker.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he pointed his gun at that old couple.
He pointed his gun at the, like, he did a 360 almost. He pointed his gun everywhere because he was just, I think he had it. I don't agree with him pointing the gun at the old couple. What's that?
It's like he was brandishing his gun.
Yeah, he was in a way. He was just kind of like, look, if anybody else gives me trouble, I will drop you in the fryer or at least your weapon.
And then when the waitress seemed concerned about handing that address over, he said, it's okay, I'm with the FBI. And his voice at that point sounded like Mr. C. Mm-hmm.
It did. Yeah.
It was unnerving. I didn't like it.
And that was a great move on their part to have Cooper act like Mr. C, even in this small capacity, because it does have that unnerving effect. And you're like, oh, geez, what's going on? What are we in for?
So Cooper then leaves and he drives to that address. There's a number 6 utility pole out front, which is weird because it makes me wonder if Carl Rod is a transplant of some sort. If somebody tried to fix his past, and maybe that's why he has a number 6 pole following him around. If like that number 6 pole is like some sort of like outgrowth of or marker of that.
Huh. I hadn't thought of that at all.
That's really good.
Or you could look at it conversely and say that the number 6 pole pops up as an indicator to show people who know what to look for where people who have been touched by the lodge or the forces as we've come to know them under whatever name are existing.
Yeah. Just remember how Carl Rod acted when Chet Desmond was in his
he got that
trailer.
1,000-mile stare and he was like, I've seen things. I just want to be left alone now. I'm paraphrasing. He said something kind of different, but the gist is still the same.
Yeah, I know he was, if we're going to look at the secret history of Twin Peaks, he was abducted.
Right.
It's weird when he pulls up. It's just a house. It's just a pink house. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
But it looks so uninviting. Like, it gives off this aura that I don't know if it's the lack of attention to the yard or there's just not any character to it, if that's why, but there's just something about it that it reminds me of like Dead Dog Farm.
Yeah, it feels unkempt in a way that's strategically done to say stay away from me, you know, like don't come here.
So a woman who looks like Laura answers the door when Cooper knocks, and she immediately asks, did you find him? Which, I mean, we could probably speculate for days about that. Maybe it's Billy, who knows? But she doesn't know who Laura Palmer is. Her name, it turns out, is Carrie Page. He says, your father's name was Leland. She doesn't respond. No, she doesn't recognize that. But when he says, your mother's name was Sarah, That definitely triggers something. Mm-hmm. She's like, Sarah? It's creepy how she responds.
Absolutely.
He wants to take her to her mother's home. She has to get out of Dodge anyway, which we'll see in a minute.
Yeah.
Because he's going to go into her home here as she packs up. There's a man sitting in a chair that has been shot in the head. And he's actually, his left hand is actually still being held up. Like he's still responding to the shock of being shot in the head. Like somehow like rigor mortis set in immediately.
Right.
Into his like bodily response to being shot.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Blue Velvet. Yes. When the guy who gets shot is like standing still.
Yeah. The man in the gold suit.
Yeah, you think that he's playing dead.
But it is funny when he tells her that, or she asks, where are we going? And he says Twin Peaks, Washington. And she says D.C. So she, also we see inside the house, other than the man, that there is a white horse before a blue plate on her mantle. So the white horse always makes me think of Sarah Palmer. Mm-hmm. And the visions she had before Laura and before Maddie were killed.
Yeah.
It's the vision of her being non-responsive, not able to help. Mm-hmm. So now in the car, she asks if he is really FBI, and he shows her his badge. We get a long stretch of night driving. There's headlights behind them, like eyes. The headlights make her nervous, and she asks if someone is following, and the car eventually passes them. I did wonder about her stress about something following, especially since we opened this episode and we ended last episode where he was trying to get her to follow out. So to rescue her from the trauma that's going to happen. And so it's like that particular thing is, it's nagging mm-hmm. at her as well, but she still doesn't want to face it, even though it's behind her now.
Yeah.
Trying to catch up.
I thought it was Quilty.
You did say that.
behind them from Lolita.
She says, after the car passes, Odessa, I tried to keep a clean house, keep everything organized. And to me, that's showing how she's trying to keep her life sterile, keep the dirty truth away. Mm-hmm. So there's something that's nagging at her.
So this isn't Laura admitting that she's Laura at this point. She's just, there's something coming through. She feels like she can open up to Cooper at least a little bit because they're on this long road trip, because it's going to take a while to get from anywhere in Texas to Washington State. So there's probably some talking on her part, not a lot on his, but some on her part about what's going on. So she's just kind of opening up. And I like that idea of she knows enough to, it's like there's something inside of her that's driving her to try to keep the clean house, keep it mm-hmm. organized, because that's at the very least you can say that, like, okay, my house is in order. Anything else that happens is outside of my control. You control what you can control. You start with the very basics at the very bottom.
She also says, it's a long way. In those days, I was too young to know any better.
See, that's the part that made me think, like, okay, is she talking about her former life, you know, when she was a teenager as Laura Palmer? Because at this point, I think we have to assume that whenever she was separated from Cooper, she was put here in Odessa, Texas.
Yeah.
Whether she woke up with memories or no memories, who knows, or mm-hmm. just like dreams or inklings of things that could have possibly happened.
But yeah, dropped into somebody else's life, kind of like Coop and them might have been. That's why the difference in names. Like, this is how you come into this reality, that you're dropped into these bodies and you have like a car waiting outside, or that way you can explain why you're there. Like, he might have been dropped into another FBI agent's body.
Hmm.
Kind of like Quantum Leap. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Like that kind of like, not that he looks different in the mirror, just you're placed there and this is the reality that you live in now. But he knows who he is still and what his mission is. She might have been placed there, to either keep her safe or keep her away from finishing her mission or his mission by Judy, that bitch.
We're not going to talk about Judy.
Sorry, my bad.
No, I actually we are, but I just love that
most
phrase.
Likely.
We're not going to talk about Judy. We're not going to talk about her at all.
They stop at a gas station, and I wondered why they showed us this. It does feel like they are the only humans on Earth for a moment until you see cars pass. But there's a long period of time where you see them exiting the gas station, walking over to the car. But it's a convenience store as well, right? So maybe that's something to consider.
Ah, I didn't even think of that. Mm-hmm. I just had this vision of them in my head driving for hours on end and in complete silence. And then she finally looks over at him and says, "We're both tulpas, you know that, right?" Then he looks at her and says, "Are you going to talk all night?" Then they continue the rest of the drive in silence. Not that I actually believe either of them are tulpas.
Yeah.
But
No. Well,
necessarily.
Right. Well, there's that blog I'm going to bring up at the end. That will kind of explain things. Cause I really have no take on this. I'm not going to lie. I was completely lost and had no idea what was going on. And you guys have already brought up things that I had missed. I'm actually kind of feeling a little better about this episode.
Cool. Cause we all need it.
Yeah.
We all need that.
So wasn't that gas station called Valero?
Yeah, it's a real gas station. Those are real.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious about the meaning. It's a derivative or related to valerian.
Mm-hmm.
Don't people take valerian to sleep?
Valerian root.
Yeah, valerian root. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it helps
taken
you go
it.
To. It's real stinky. It's mm-hmm. It smells nasty. Even
like
when
feet.
They make them in. Yeah, it's like they make them into nice little pills, but if you smell the bottle, it just smells gross, and so. But it makes you, it's right up there with mm-hmm. melatonin. It's like a co-ingredient in a lot of natural sleep aids.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, being that we've got discussion about who is the dreamer.
Absolutely.
I mean, they could have picked any gas station, right?
Yeah. I mean, in everything else, Twin Peaks, it's never been an actual real gas station. You know, it's always like a made up version. That it's a real gas station in real life is interesting in its own right. Even the way that it's filmed, it's very realistic.
So now pulling into the town of Twin Peaks, he asks her if she recognizes anything. She doesn't. Now parked in front of the Palmer House, he again asks if she recognizes it. She doesn't. He takes her hand and he starts to walk her up towards the house and up its steps. So it's kind of ironic that he's taking her hand and pulling her up and away. It's really brief that he actually holds her hand
still
here,
though.
But he tried to pull her away from the trauma. Now he's trying to get her to face it,
yeah.
It seems like.
And it was very similar to him walking through the woods with her. You know, she was behind him. You'd think he would
exactly.
be like, "I'm going to walk behind you this time. You go first."
So the woman who answers the door is not who he expects. It is not Sarah Palmer, but a Mrs. Tremond. And she and her husband bought the house from a Mrs. Chalfant. This is hair-raising, especially if you're like, wait, what time is it? How much time do we have left in this episode?
Yeah. And supposedly, this is the woman that owns the house in real life. I read it on that blog that they had actually found the woman. Yeah, that whoever's house it is in real life, that is her playing
cool.
the owner of the house. Interesting.
Cool. That's cool. That fact she's Mrs. Tremond is not cool, though.
No, that's bad. That's not really her name in real life. That would be cool as fuck, but no.
And her first name is Alice?
Alice. Mm-hmm. Alice Wakefield.
Alice in Wonderland.
Do you happen to know who she bought it from? No, regarding Mrs. Chalfant. So they don't know who Mrs. Chalfant originally bought this house from. They say goodnight. Sorry for bothering you. Laura and Dale walk quietly back to the car. Dale is... It's funny I'm saying Dale now. Weird. Cooper, I think this is like the most human he seemed to me out of all of Twin Peaks, because he's just like dumbfounded. He doesn't know what the next step is. And he's in the street and he's searching and he just has this thought and he turns to her and he says, "What year is this?" And Laura looks at the house and she hears Sarah yelling, "Laura," the same scream and yell from the pilot. And this is when Laura begins that blood-curdling scream. The lights surge and short out in the house and then fade to black. And we have Laura back in the lodge with Cooper doing the whisper again. We are not actually given any indication of what she actually said to him like we did in the original series. Credits begin to roll.
Okay, so in that blog that I read, real quick, right? I'm going to give a quick synopsis of it. You can find it on my Twitter feed. I'm going to leave it at the top. I'm not going to post anything for a few days. I'm going to let it kind of soak in. What he describes is that Audrey's trapped in the dream, right? With Billy, whoever the fuck Billy is. This really doesn't mean anything to me, but Audrey's trapped in the dream. And that we're the dreamers. The TV show is the tulpa. The whole TV show is the tulpa. Yeah, I know. But... Dale and them, the reason why he has like stuff to prove this, right? And I love the idea of this. And I want to give him credit again. Theon 3 at Blogspot, or Theon3 at WordPress, I'm sorry, at .com. And the entire time they're out of when they come through and he's in the new car, you know, in the last half of this episode, you see an actual town sign, Odessa, Texas, with a number of people. You see a real gas station. When they showed the R&R Cafe, it's the one in real life, not the one from the show. It didn't have the stuff on it. You know, it shows everything. So, like, they're in our world now. That's why Sarah Palmer doesn't live there anymore, because they're actually where the dreamer's at and not in the dream anymore.
They've been brought into our reality.
Exactly. It's kind of like breaking the whole fourth wall, because, like, when it showed him in the episode before, it's not that he was staring off. He's staring at us. So that wall is broken there. He's staring at us watching the episode. And then when Gordon Cole's looking over, like I said in the previous episode, over his shoulder about the dream, he's looking at us and then sees himself. So all of it is like little clues. And it's just a really good take. And it made this episode kind of like feel okay to me, because I'd been so turned off by it that it's like, okay, this is a really cool theory that I can grab onto, because I honestly had absolutely nothing. And it's sad, because of what we do for fun with our podcast. I felt betrayed, you know, and after reading this, I really did. I felt betrayed. And after reading this, it really did make it like, okay, now I can kind of go on. And I wanted to talk to you guys about it. And I want our listeners to read it, you know, and see what they think. And then, like, I'm so excited about our feedback coming up, because I want to hear what people have to say and how they felt about these last couple episodes to put the cream on the burn. But I liked how he brought them into our reality. You know, it's genius.
Yeah, so I need to read that article. So just out of curiosity, what about the fact that they're pulled into our reality made it easier for you to swallow it?
Because it made sense. Otherwise, none of it really made sense to me. Like, what would, like, he's saying what year it is. That made it kind of like, it doesn't matter what year it is, because this is the reality that you're in. This is, you're in reality. So that's why Dale was acting different, because he's an actual person. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't the Dale from the Tulpa or the Dale from the dream. This is the Dale that's in our reality, and how a person would react compared to the I know everything Dale Cooper.
He was like the, in our version, he's the idolized version of himself, to where he's the perfect Eagle Scout who does everything right, and he doesn't have sex with Audrey, and he doesn't do bad things, and blah, 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 blah. He does have sex with Wyndham Earl's wife, but at least she's not in high school, right?
Yeah.
So you have so what you're saying is, this guy is flawed. This guy can be an asshole and a jerk, and, you know, trying to get things done that he wants to get done.
I don't know if it's as far as that, just that he's in just a completely different reality. You know what I mean? Like, exactly. Right. Like, it's not like he's trying to be. Like you said, when he walks towards his car and he's like all humanized, because he doesn't know what's going on. Because every other time when he's Dale Cooper, he knows, like, boom, when I drop these guns in here, move back, because the bullets are going to go off. He doesn't know. He's like, oh, you might want to step back. I'm not sure. Has he ever said I'm not sure before? I don't remember it. So I like the idea that they were the dreamer, and that they brought him into our reality. Now, who knows where they're at now? They could have been transported when the lights went out to back to the lodge and it all starts over again. I have no idea at that point, but it did make it, it just explained the episode enough to where I can grab onto something, because otherwise I was just flailing and felt betrayed. You know, it made it kind of like a complete piece for me.
That is intriguing, and I want to read it now. Especially since, you know, mentioning how he, like, identified us with his looming face.
Yeah.
And they
brought the woman that owns the house in real life to play the part of the woman who owns the house in real life. Mm-hmm. Or the actual, that you don't see, he brings up that you don't even see the Twin Peaks sign.
I was about to say that.
How do we know they're there except for the R&R Cafe?
I was just about to say that, because the Double R Cafe does exist in reality. Mm-hmm. But if he's saying, and I haven't done the research, so I'm just going to say it like this. If it's true, what he's saying, that it's portrayed in the show exactly how it looks without it being doctored up to be its character counterpart in Twin Peaks. And then when they drive through, they don't see the telltale Twin Peaks sign that has the population on it and so on and so forth. So everything is real and they're coming into.
Yeah, even in it's a two-part blog, and it's only a few paragraphs, but he starts this theory before the last two episodes. And then he's like, I've just watched the last two episodes, and here's some more evidence of what's going on. It really is, and I don't do this. If you've ever listened to our other podcasts, I really try and stay true to my feelings, but I had nothing. I literally read this a few hours ago. So it's something to check out. Because I think it's just a valid thing. And, but just like M said at the beginning, it's a theory. You know, I'm not saying it's the right theory, but it's the theory that I can grab onto.
Yeah. And there's a lot of parts that work within that, that theory.
Yeah. I'm sure our listeners will put up another one and I'll be like, ooh, that's the theory I want. And then 10 years from now, we'll have another one. Yeah. Yeah. Like poops in our world. And then it would make another series even crazier, if that's even possible.
Now, without the benefit of having further Twin Peaks material that's going to appear on a screen, be it big or little, as far as we know right now, let's just assume that it's not going to happen because all of the indicators point to it not happening, right? Now, of course, in the year 2014 or 2013, we probably thought that that was the case about the return, that this was something that was never, ever going to happen. But a lot of the principal, not a lot, but there's a good number of people who were in this have passed away, more than your usual show from season to season.
Yeah.
David Lynch is not getting any younger. He's in his mid-70s, right?
72.
Yeah. 72. So he's going into his mid-70s, or his early 70s at least. And we have no guarantees. It's most likely not going to happen, but even if it does, there's no guarantees. The ratings for this weren't as good as somebody like, you know, the execs at Showtime probably would have wanted. I think personally, they're going to recoup their money on DVDs or Blu-rays,
or whoever, stuff like that. Netflix, or whoever picks it up, too.
Right, or merchandising in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they could just make a bunch of coffee mugs, they'll be good to go.
Right.
But having said all that, there's a lot of stuff that gets left hanging. A lot of things that don't get followed up on. I mean, we could literally go down a list of anywhere, you know, 15 to 20 to, or more things that we thought we were going to see a resolution to that we did not see a resolution to. We have an episode that's very sparse as far as action and interaction is concerned. And this left a lot of spaces in between for any number of things to be packed in there by Lynch and Frost. Yet they chose to give us this at this pace. At this time, they weren't forced by a deadline. They, you know, didn't have anything looming over their heads. This is what they wanted us to see and how they wanted us to see it. So given that, I mean, I don't know if that changes anybody's opinion on how they feel about the end of it. But I mean, especially now, given that you've kicked in this theory about how this could be like are you like satisfied with that being the end?
Oh no,
like,
yeah, I'm kind not of being like trapped in satisfied at all means, but
right,
it makes it easier, I should say. It gives me something to go to wrap my brain around. Otherwise, like I said before, if you could literally watch episode 1 and episode 18 and not need any of the internal part, you don't need it. None of it made any difference. None of it, you know. So it's like it made it to where it's like, okay, if I kind of get it now, because if that's true, then everything, the Tulpa and everything else being the Twin Peaks that we all love, it's like, you know, it gives me at least something to hold on to instead of just feeling like I'm what that guy in that one episode was brushing around on the floor. And that's what David Lynch thinks of me. Like, okay, I just need to sweep for a little while because I just watched an episode where they're just driving for most of it, not hardly saying anything. And I had no idea what was going on. You know, I felt abused in my own right. It's like, what's he think? So it just helped. It just helped me feel – it just helped me feel better. I don't want to say satisfied. I mean, that was a long way around it. I'm sure you'll help me sound a little better than that. But yes,
no, I
do feel a little better.
I've definitely heard theories before of things that I didn't quite feel like I had wrapped my head around that made me go, oh, okay, if you look at it that way, that's a little bit – you know,
Now, I have a question for y'all real quick. Which season ending is better, season two or this season? Which one which one do you like better? Yeah, that's fucked up.
Time's going to have to tell on that one.
For sure.
And
both of them are devastating.
Yes.
Intensely devastating.
Oh, time's going to have to tell for me. I'm going to have to give that a couple of years to digest and eventually do a rewatch where I start, you know, a leisurely rewatch where I start from the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. With the pilot and go all the way through the return, and then I'll let you know.
Yeah, okay.
Do you think that the atom bomb that we saw in part 8, which is actually a historical event that happened in our reality, mm-hmm. is one of the few things that actually links all the various dream realities that are overlapping here?
Right. I think that could possibly be. You know what I mean?
So it kind of like punctured it a little bit and mm-hmm. some things kind of bled in maybe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I still loved the journey and I loved everything. And hey, I don't agree with how it ended, but it was still something that, just like all the other episodes, it was completely unexpected.
You know, the journey is definitely a good thing to bring mm-hmm. up because that has been a delight.
Absolutely.
Especially being a podcaster and where we're having to apply the way we think about shows when we were podcasting to this show, enriched it, and then having everybody write in with their theories and the excitement. I actually re-listened to our podcast for part 16 mm-hmm. and all the hope. Oh my gosh. I was feeling so bad for us listening to that.
You know, one of the things that Daniel had brought up in feedback early on mm-hmm. in the return, which I thought was is especially pertinent now, is the idea of how much we like Twin Peaks is always going to be predicated upon how much our storytelling has to be linear mm-hmm. and resolvable for us to enjoy it. So keeping that thought going forward, once you get to the end and you've fooled yourself, you know what David Lynch is. You've seen the original run of Twin Peaks. You've seen Fire Walk With Me. You've seen his other movies. You know that he doesn't like to stay linear and normal and safe, and he doesn't give you the resolutions that he wants, so that you want. So you know the old saying where they say, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So going into this, any of us who thought that we were going to get this resolution, and I think I thought we were going to get some of it. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was going to happen. So I'm in that crowd too. We set ourselves up for this.
Oh, for sure.
But I think it's something that we wanted to see so badly, and we thought, okay, maybe this one time we're going to get what we really want out of it. But it wouldn't be real Lynch if he gave you what you wanted. You know, and that's why I feel like there's two endings to this. There's an ending that kind of does give fans what they want in a roundabout fashion, at least somewhat, a facsimile mm-hmm. of it. Then there's David Lynch's ending. And
Frost, one was David Lynch.
Well, there you go. There you go. You could look at it that way too. Now, going back to the blogger's theory for a minute though, if Coop is trapped, I'm not trying to poke holes in it. It just occurred to me that if Coop is now stranded, so to speak, in the real world, our world, the Tremonts and the Chalfonts probably wouldn't be their names. She would just be like, oh, my name's Mrs. Michaels.
Well, that's the thing. That's kind of me putting my spin on it. He never says trapped. He just says he's in our reality.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, that's just me, you know.
So, but then it would be a nod to the fact that he's outside of his own, his known reality.
Exactly.
And trying to get back in. But this particular reality is ours and he's looking into it. And so he's with us now looking into the reality. So one thing I wanted to talk about is, unless you had something to say.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, when he goes back to the lodge after Laura disappears that first time and Mike asks him once again, is it future or is it past? It becomes even more of a pertinent question because I think of the time in the return where Laura is put into the orb, put in by the fireman and put into the mechanical thing and then shot back out. If it's past, then whenever he took Laura through the forest that night and then she disappeared, she could have ended up back in the fireman's realm, maybe going through some other realms first. But she ends up the fireman up there and then with him and Dido. And then he shoots her back out.
As
and
Carrie
she,
Page.
As Carrie Page. Mm-hmm. And so she ends up living her existence, nice. Not dying as she did in the car with Bob and everything, mm-hmm. but as Carrie Page. But the core is still there. The essence of yeah. it is still there. What we once thought was going to be weaponized goodness in the fight at this end, you know.
Well, the reason why we thought that is because it seemed like he created her in response to seeing the rent.
Yeah.
The what resulted after the atom bomb.
Yeah, and apparently that was just a rerun, you know. Yeah, he was just watching
what
old
does
movies.
Time mean to the fireman anyway, though? You know, that's the thing. Yeah.
True.
I, you know, as Mike, every time he sees Coop in the lodge over all those years, is he always asking that same question?
What
you
does
know?
Distance mean to Jerry Horn?
Yeah, right.
Or clothing.
Right. With his killer binoculars.
Oh, man. I wish we could have seen him walk up to the police station butt naked, and that'd been amazing. Just.
Well, so this was an episode that managed to do almost the impossible, which was to take everybody's expectations and flush them down the toilet.
Yeah.
And say, none of you are getting what you thought uh-huh. you were going to get. Sometimes some people are going to think that's for the better. Some people are going to think it's for the worse. But it's a fact that they just defied it once again. And the ability to do that is storytelling genius. Mm-hmm. Whether you walk away from that going, that was the most awesome thing I've ever seen, or what the fuck, screw those guys.
Plus, like, if we were to get another season, it would actually make more sense to me to have another cliffhanger like this again, mm-hmm. where it's you've got this story of a adventurer or detective that, instead of it being the Hardy Boys or whatever, like, you've got somebody who's in this fucked up world and Venn diagram type universes that are crossing over, and he's trapped in there and he can never get out. He maybe makes a little bit of progress from time to time, mm-hmm. but overall he's stuck and the cycle starts over again and starts over again. Like, that would be a lot more interesting as a series that carried on.
Well, you know, you're going to view this very differently if you think that there's another series coming down the pike in another 2-3 couple years, mm-hmm. then if you think that this is the last will and testament of Twin Peaks as a television show or as a visual medium yeah. at all. So if you leave us thinking that, it leaves a much deeper psychic imprint in your mm-hmm. mind going forward, kind of like when, you know, How's Annie? Mm-hmm. You know, that was what everybody thought was going to be it, you know, forever. Or they got to understand, anyway, that was going to be it. And it was for over 25 years, so...
So if there was another series, we would never learn what year is this.
Yeah.
Just probably. Like we never learned yeah. how is Annie.
I mean, who knows where it would even pick up? You know, because at the very end when the credits are rolling, they're back in the lodge and she's whispering in his ear. Who knows? It just didn't suck him back into the lodge. There's no telling.
Yeah. But like after everything popped. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When everything popped and the lights went out and then it takes us straight to her whispering in his ear. There's literally an open, like a clean slate for him to do anything, a movie or anything, and go any direction he wanted in now. Like before, you know, you kind of had a direction he needed to follow with all the people that are in Twin Peaks and, you know, everything else. Now, he could do a Twin Peaks movie with just Kyle MacLachlan, and that would be it. And it would be
car.
Twin Peaks. Yeah. He could literally put all new characters, all new places, and everything and call it Twin Peaks.
He could have filmed it already, and it's in a vault until
yep.
he dies.
It totally could be with Prince's albums.
I feel like you can be a Twin Peaks fan and have enjoyed this journey. Like, if you are a Twin Peaks fan, most likely you did enjoy this journey. But to really enjoy this last episode and to want to kind of peel back the onion layers, you have to be a David Lynch fan.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been said about the series in general, The Return, versus the original Twin Peaks, and it's true. But I think more than anything else, even more than episode or part 8, that it holds true for this, is that you have to be a David Lynch fan, because you look at what was going on in this episode and you feel like, I walked away feeling like it was almost like David Lynch said, this isn't Twin Peaks right now. This is me taking a character and a kind of sort of maybe character from Twin Peaks and putting them in a 57 minute long movie
mm-hmm.
that is done in my style.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I felt like this went. And so if some people are going to have a problem just with that, because especially when you have the people who tend to like Mark Frost's contributions a little bit better for whatever reasons they have for doing that, are going to maybe feel a little bit turned off by this and be the ones who have their ire raised the most.
Mm-hmm. I think some people have learned, though. There was a very strong reaction against Fire Walk With Me when it first came out, and then over time, people have warmed back up to it. I think that's also in people's awareness. So I think they're going to be less likely to react strongly. I think they're going to react more thoughtfully. At least the OG fans will,
mm-hmm.
because they haven't forgotten that. So
yeah, we understand that there's something of merit and worth to every addition to, you know, the Twin Peaks mythology.
Supposedly he's going to explain everything in the final dossier, so we shall see.
Sure. Get ready for more questions and one answer filled. That's it.
And it's not going to be what year is this or how's Annie.
Nope.
We need to write our own fan book and just call it Shut Up, Chad.
Shut Up, Chad.
Yeah. All right, so you guys want to...
We got to give away the mug.
Oh,
yep. It's time.
What time is it? What year is this?
All right, so I've got all the names already on pieces of paper. They're in the owl vase that I had made, so, you know, maybe there's luck for somebody. All right, so here we go. Ready? All right, so I've got a name. All right, so it's Kenny 2273. Kenny...
Right.
2273. Good job, Kenny. If you will send your name and address to noshipnetwork@gmail.com, we will get it to you as soon as we can. And thank you so much for leaving a review. Thanks to everybody for leaving a review. You guys are amazing. Definitely keep giving us more if you've enjoyed it. You know, we always love reading what you guys have written.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, and congratulations.
Yes, thank you, Kenny 2273. And congratulations. And all right, so that's it for now. Once again, if you are planning on writing feedback into our podcast to discuss the series finale, please keep your feedback down to 2 to 3 paragraphs. We're anticipating a lot of feedback on this, understandably so. And once again, the deadline is Sunday, September 10th at 6:00 Eastern Standard Time. That's it, you guys.
All right. So one last time for Twin Peaks. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Wait, what year is this?
Fade to black.
J-U-D-Y. She don't need no alibi. It's Judy.